Hiya, welcome to another episode of Zero Ambitions, a podcast about sustainability and the built environment. So with us this week is Nigel Banks, who lots of our listeners may well be familiar with already, but currently Nigel is Technical Director for Zero Bills and Low Carbon Homes at Octopus Energy. He's one of the people involved in developing the Octopus Energy Zero Bills proposition, which people may have heard of. We talk about it in the episode. I'll get into that in a minute. But yeah, he's been around for ages doing all sorts of really interesting things. Most recently, he was R&D director at Ilka Homes. Ilka was the outfit that were revolutionising, or had the potential to revolutionise, the modular build industry in the UK, along with a bunch of other runners. They were doing something really interesting, but something went wrong, and it is no more. But it seems like that has sort of evolved into what he's doing now at Octopus. It used to be Keepmoat, which some of the heads may already be very familiar with their work. So we are going to be doing an episode about Octopus Energy's Zero Bills Homes proposition. It's a really interesting thing. But this week, we invited Nigel on to talk about an article he wrote on LinkedIn called Fabric Fifth. With a keen sense of iconoclasm, he's challenging fabric first dogma, and in doing so, prioritizing or laying out a different way of prioritizing retrofit, I suppose. And in that sense, it's a really apposite follow up to our last episode with Fionn Stevenson. Now, you could say Fabric Fifth is like a decarbonization philosophy. He offers a hierarchy of measures to be applied to any home, which are, so number one, air source heat pumps as soon as possible. Number two, use smart technology to manage your consumption better. Three, do more measuring. Check what you're using and adapt. Four, get on solar energy and storage technology to make more of the prior measures and reduce your bills and consume energy when it's least carbon intensive and cheapest. And then fifth, you can get on the fabric. So it's really sympathetic to Fionn's low-hanging fruit. Now, it is primarily retrofit-focused, but ultimately it is a bit of a global concept. It could apply as much to new build, even if the builder doesn't really care about standards of insulation and airtightness. I mean, they should still be installing a heat pump. And similarly, an occupant should be using smart technology to manage their energy use, expenditure, alongside solar storage, where this is possible. It's not going to be accessible to everyone, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, in addition to this, we do talk about the Zero Bills home offer quite a lot. They're not interchangeable. Currently, Zero Bills only applies to new build homes. There is a fabric first element in that proposition, insofar as developers and builders have to build to a certain specification standard. But you know, it's high spec with all the things, SLC pumps, smart technology. It's just the fabric is an intrinsic quality. Anyway, right. It's just me and Jeff with Nigel. It was really good fun. Hope you enjoy it. Oh, and last thing, Alex and I are going to be at Future Build in the UK on Wednesday and Thursday. So if you're knocking about, give us a shout, say hello. And we're presenting the first panel on the retrofit stage on the Thursday. If you want to come along, say hello. You'll definitely find us both lurking about there. All right. Cheers. Thanks for listening. We've done all the housekeeping, Jeff. Man, what's going on?
Hang on, just setting up the microphone as well.
No problem. No, I'm not negging you to make you feel bad. Like, I'm just curious.
Is it a snow day where you are?
No.
It is here, and I don't know if that's the cause or whatever. It's been pelting down, and for some reason my internet stopped working, but it's working now.
Cool.
Anyway, right. Sorry, Nigel.
You two know each other.
Yeah, it's a long time since I've spoken to you. I think you were at Keepmoat at the time, is that right?
Yeah, I was at Keepmoat from 2010 to 2017, and then we set up Ilka off the back of Keepmoat, so that was kind of an extension of there until last summer when it went under. So, yeah, at Keepmoat we did some of the early Pascal schemes, so Wimbish, Ditchingham, and St Mary's, Oldham as well.
Amazing projects. I recall, if I remember correctly, I think Kate de Selincourt picked up on an angle you were looking at in the context of direct electric heating, for all of its inefficiency compared to heat pumps, being potentially interesting in low energy buildings, given the ability to respond very quickly to intermittent sort of renewable energy supply in the grid. Was that you?
Yeah, I think certainly around the benefits of electrification beyond decarbonisation and the ability to move when you use your energy on in the electricity market, if you're on the right tariff, unlocks massive bill savings and also helps the grid and makes it lower carbon. And yet that can be done through heat pumps, or it could be done through direct electrical heating. That world is coming pretty strongly through now, but we need to decarbonize, and that's electrification is that route for housing. But when you use your energy is almost as important as how much, perhaps some of the discussion we'll get into.
So have you written in the pages of Passive House Plus before? Was that a connection, or did you just feature?
I don't think I have written in Passive House Plus. No. Some of the projects have obviously been featured quite heavily that Keepmoat built. And then I did speak at the Passive House conference 2012, I think, 2011. So quite a while ago.
All right. Well, perhaps I've just opened a door to you submitting today's subject for the pages of Passive House Plus. So the reason we asked you on, apart from your illustrious background, which we will ask you to just give our listeners a bit of an explanation of, in case they don't know who you are already. But we've been talking for a while trying to find an angle to have you on the podcast. And there's a couple of things we've explored. But then you suggested the Fabric Fifth article that you posted to LinkedIn some time ago. And, oh man, yeah. Oh, it's excellent. So that might work for, well, in fact, that certainly would work for the pages of Passive House Plus.
Yeah, absolutely. We are, we're not as dogmatic as our name might suggest. And obviously I'm aware that with a decarbonizing grid, the landscape starts to shift quite a bit.
All right. Do you want to tell our listeners who you are?
Yep. So Nigel Banks, I'm a chartered building services engineer by background. So I started actually working at AECOM, what used to be Oscar Faber, doing a lot of energy simulation work, computational modeling, all the early BRIAM, eco homes type work. As part of that, worked on various different housing, offices, schools, design as a services engineer and looking at energy work. And then off the back of that, we got some work delivering the M&E design for some innovative projects. And we designed, as AECOM, 100 of the first 120 zero carbon code 6 houses. And then I then actually shifted and went and joined Keepmoat, who actually ended up building them. So I got to see it from both sides of the lens, and certainly would recommend anyone in the world of consulting to spend some time working for contractors, because you'll see what really happens and what really works and what things really cost. And that was really interesting to see. So then I worked at Keepmoat doing a mixture of new build housing and social housing refurbishment. So Keepmoat were largely a kitchen and bathrooms refurbishment contractor doing decent homes work. And we helped grow that into quite a significant retrofit business. And then the overall Keepmoat business was sold to Engie. And when in 2015, when David Cameron cut the green crap, when all that money towards energy and retrofit works disappeared, we looked at something different to do to grow other parts of the Keepmoat business. And I led the R&D project that created Ilka Homes, which is the modular housing manufacturer that was launched in 2017, 2018, and grew up to doing about 5 houses a day out of the factory last summer, when unfortunately it came to a fairly sudden close, ran out of funds. But we were doing some great stuff, and we built some of the first homes that were accredited for zero bills with Octopus Energy. And I've now joined the Octopus Energy team, so that's where I work now. My day job is technical director of zero bills and low carbon homes at Octopus Energy, and now trying to work with all of the major house builders, as well as lots of SME builders, to build voluntarily to a higher standard, which delivers zero energy bills guaranteed by Octopus Energy. So we can perhaps get into that. But through that process of understanding retrofit costs, retrofit my own homes, understanding how energy works a bit more, I've come to the conclusion that deep retrofit of all homes in the UK is definitely not the way we need to go. I'm not saying don't do fabric works. Sometimes we definitely need some fabric works. But is a deep retrofit the answer for everything? And certainly people saying that you need to do deep retrofits before you can move to a heat pump definitely isn't true. And that was really drove some of the reasons for writing an article that was perhaps a little bit punchy, deliberately so. set it out in a different framework that hopefully will be useful for people, and hopefully not misconstrued to saying we don't think we should Fabric. It's on the list. It's fifth, but it's perhaps not first as it once was.
But yeah. would you be saying? I mean, the thing is, when you outline a position like this, and I guess this is a thought piece and a bit of a polemic as well in some ways, that it's not like every building is the same, so you can't, this list of priorities surely would change depending on the situation you're facing in a given building, right? And the needs of the particular users of the building and so on.
To some extent, yes, but to some extent, no. My general view is now, and it wasn't 10 years ago, but my view now is the most important thing we need to do as society is get off gas heating systems as soon as we can. So for me, air source heat pumps as soon as possible is priority number one. And you can do that today without insulating your home, without changing your pipe work from microbore with higher temperature heat pumps. You may not get quite as efficiency as you get from a lower temperature heat pump with larger radiators and running at 35 degree flow temperatures, but you can still do that today in every home in the country. Pretty much bar none, there is a electrical heating solution, and most of them will be a heat pump led solution, which we should do. And I don't think anything should be getting in the way of that to some extent from a priority and perspective. So whether you do the heat pump in parallel with other fabric measures, or whether you do the fabric measures afterwards, and you could do it beforehand, but you shouldn't delay moving off get away from fossil fuel oil or gas heating. So I think that, in my mind, that should be first in almost all scenarios. And ideally, you'd do it in parallel with basic lofts, cavity, draft proofing, and be on a smart tariff so you can make significant bill savings at the same time with electric heat. And that was the earlier conversation around, if you can control when you use electricity and you're on a smart tariff, the cost of energy is massively different. I think that's one of the things that, certainly talking to a lot of house builders, around our zero bills proposition, they're not aware that the cost of energy changes massively every half hour in the UK. So the price today is about, I think it's about 15 kilowatt hour today at the moment, but at 4 o'clock it will jump to 35p a kilowatt hour. And at night, if it's windy, it'll go down to zero or even negatively priced energy. So if you can move when you use your energy around, you can massively reduce that cost of energy. And also it generally aligns that when it's low cost, it's lower carbon, because we're not having to pay to turn on the coal plant still. And that's when the electricity is very expensive. That's when the costs of energy are expensive and the carbon's expensive. So I would say that heat pump first viewpoint is there. And I think that's probably supported by quite a few others in the broader industry. Certainly, I think it's been interesting seeing the Association of Environmentally Conscious Building, AECB, with their step-by-step retrofit. And step one is heat pumps with a plan for doing more.
But it's a bit more than that. I mean, step one does include fabric measures up to a point. It's quite well aligned with the Super Homes scheme in Ireland, actually, which is an air tightness of 5, mechanical ventilation, insulate where you can, and then heat pump and you know, larger emitters, larger rads or whatever, if you need to try and run as low a temperature as you can. But there is a question in my own mind as to whether that's far enough, because I find that, I should say, Nigel, that I have a few hats, and one of them is that I chair the Heat Pump Association of Ireland too. You know, you might expect me to be arguing with myself on this point, but no, there's actually, I think there's a degree of pragmatism. Most of the people we talk to, and even in the pacifist community, are thinking along these kinds of lines too. And the thing that offends me in this regard, and I've put this to our members in the context of talking to the state about retrofit grants and so on, you know, heat pump retrofit grants. You know, what happens? It's December, Mrs. Murphy's boiler breaks down and she needs the heating back on immediately because it's today it's freezing, it's snowing, you know, she wants the heat back on immediately. She rings her local plumber and he, because invariably he, tells her, yep, boiler. You know, what you want is a boiler, a new boiler, and she's tied to fossil fuels for another 10 or 15 years. In order to get the grants as it stands now, she needs to get a technical assessment done to assess the condition of the house. The typical wait time is in the region of about 6 weeks. So heat pumps are, in terms of a grant at least, are completely gone for her as an option. You know, so how do we create a situation to enable her installer to be able to turn around to her and say, okay, here's what we do. We can find a way. It's going to be maybe not optimal, but we'll find a way to get a heat pump into your building now. And maybe there's some other measures, quick fire measures that we can do. Maybe there's some rule of thumb we can go work off for the house. It's a bit vague, I know. And then we can review it a couple of months down the line. Is there something in that?
I think there is something in that, but I think that's also sort of arguing with yourself a little bit, because
I'm great at that. Yeah.
If you said that you also had to procure a cavity wall installer to come and do the cavity wall installation before you fitted the heat pump, that's going to take even longer.
Yeah.
And more than that, what we've seen at Octopus Energy is that people who want a heat pump and are ready to do it, when you say you need to change these radiators, you need to upgrade this, you need to change that, you get a dropout of customers, and they get their loss for 10 years as well. So I think if you can have solutions that enable people to retrofit quickly and simply just the heating system, because that's just what they're interested in doing, we need to make that happen. At the moment, with the grant regime in the UK, there's a huge amount of people getting heat pumps. The ramping up of the grant has actually created a bit of a backlog now, so there is generally a waiting list for heat pumps, but we should get to a position soon, and Octopus is massively recruiting a huge number of extra heat pump engineers. I think we're up to a couple of thousand already, and a couple of thousand planned this year to be trained. That will enable us to quickly be able to install when people need to. There are some technical challenges around cylinders, and if you haven't got a cylinder in the home, how you manage that, and that's some stuff that we're working on from an R&D perspective. But insisting that you have to do major fabric measures before fitting the heat pump, in order to mean you haven't got to upgrade your radiators, will stop people getting heat pumps, and then they'll be stopped for 10 years because they'll have a gas boiler and it'll be fine for 10 years, and then they won't. Then you've lost that decarbonisation opportunity for quite some time. So I think there is definitely, a view that if you can do the fabric measures, the basic fabric measures at the same time, absolutely makes sense. Definitely do it if you can, but don't let it be the reason not to get going with heat pumps, would be my...
But isn't the real challenge there the fact that, like, we're talking about heat pumps like they're a commodity product, or gas boilers, and they are. Like, they're an essential service within one's home. Like, you've got to have heat. You've got to have hot water. You can't live without it. So Jeff's example of Mrs. Murphy, or Mrs. Miggins, the anglicised version, if she hasn't prepped her supply chain for when that boiler breaks down, she's only going to have one choice, like that she has to go for a boiler because she can't live. And as you said, that's her locked in. So even if she has already accepted that she doesn't need to worry about her radiators, pipes or insulation, she can get that fixed up afterwards. Just the fact that she isn't already prepared in advance for that heat pump purchase, like that locks her into a gas boiler, because you can just get one of them.
So you do have your heating off when you have a gas boiler replaced, and your hot water when you take your combi swap. It's usually only for a few hours, and on some heat pump installs it can be just for a few hours. If you've already got a cylinder and you're just doing some minor works, it can be done if you can line it up. The problem is, at the moment, you can't ring up your local plumber and get the heat pump fitted, and largely they'll be saying heat pumps aren't great because they're not trained on fitting heat pump. They'll promote a gas boiler, and that is something that is starting to change, and we're trying to do a lot in that space. There's lots of others doing a lot in that space, but we need to get to that point where it can be done, and your heating is only off for a few hours in the majority of cases, and it can be done as a, perhaps ideally in an emergent situation, but certainly in a short term, it's on its last legs. It needs to be replaced. I've got a few weeks to do it and get it on and off, the heating on and off, back on again in a day. And that happens now in some installs. And that's the big area of focus at Octopus is around. That's one of the reasons we created our own heat pump, was we were frustrated that with the cost of the equipment, but also the cost of the installation process. And so developing a heat pump that is suitable for more locations, more house types, and is quicker and easier to install, that doesn't require a lot of the upgrades internally, and has already got all the equipment to smart control the heat pump with the prices on the grid, enables us to do that. And that's a big area of focus going forward. So the technology is definitely moving on. Heat pumps, higher temperature heat pumps, and the performance of heat pumps has improved significantly. The ability to integrate with smart towers is there. So that's one and two on my list. And then three is do the basic measures, lofts, cavities and ventilation, draft proofing, and ideally some measurements so you know how your home is actually performing, understand a little bit about the air quality, understand a little bit about what your energy bills are, what tariffs you're on. So you've got a better understanding. that was the 1, 2, 3 on my list. I think the one that probably has been the most contentious is putting solar PV and storage above fabric, deep fabric measures. So fabric fifth, I'm saying deep retrofit, external, okay, internal wall insulation, triple glazing, major retrofit work. So for me, the basic loft cavities and draft proofings was in my step three. So get a heat pump, get it on a smart tariff and smart controls to lower your costs. That gets you decarbonized and lower running costs. If you can do the basic measures there and then, great. If you do it later on the next year or so, great. But it shouldn't let you stop you doing it. And then the next one up is putting solar and storage above external wall insulation, internal wall insulation. And this definitely, Jeff, to your point around nuance, is a point of nuance. So there are some houses where solar and storage, you haven't got roof space or and you can't fit solar. And there's some houses that are horrifically badly insulated or not insulated and single glazed, and they need glazing upgrades and they need some external wall insulation or internal wall insulation. So that situation definitely does occur. But does it make economic sense for the state to fund that for everyone and do to require that as being the solution for everyone is kind of where I'm coming from. So there's definitely houses that need fabric measures doing and should be supported, particularly in social housing and areas of deprivation. But solar and storage makes financial and carbon sense more than deep fabric measures. From the analysis that I've done, and I think others have done, the embodied carbon in solar does have a carbon payback if you use the certain panels, certainly.
Yeah.
The embodied carbon in deep fabric measures, internal wall insulation, external wall insulation, triple glazing, generally doesn't, even with fairly low carbon materials, and certainly not with the petrochemical insulation products, and even with sort of the rock wall type mineral wall products, the embodied carbon paybacks aren't there from what I can, from the certainly the analysis.
That's interesting. That is interesting. I think if you start moving into materials like cellulose and so on, in particular, it would start to change. I would imagine in that analysis, you know.
And some of the discussion point I've said is if we, well, I think we should be supporting deep fabric measures in many homes, but we shouldn't be government supporting it on the basis of just doing it with petrochemical or rock wall type insulation products. Part of that, there should be a ratcheting up requirement for lower embodied carbon materials to grow that supply chain, and make that become the norm and to actually deliver carbon savings. Because otherwise, you're by doing fabric, deep fabric measures, you're actually increasing emissions that you'll never get those emissions back through operational savings that generally don't have a carbon payback. And I know a lot of people don't like that word and don't like that terms, but the upfront emissions. The discussion with Fionn last week was around some of this as well, that carbon burp is significant and doesn't pay back. So as a result of that, I put solar with storage above that. Solar on its own makes economic and carbon sense. Solar with storage can have a payback from a carbon point of view, but the storage really unlocks massive savings on bills for consumers.
How are you putting together the carbon payback calculation? Just roughly, we don't need to get too deep into that.
External wall insulation, probably 4 tons of carbon with a rock wall external wrap on a typical 80 square meter house and semi-detached, sort of, that sort of ballpark. If you're on an oil heating system, there'll be a payback on the carbon. If you're on gas, there might be. If you're on electric heating and you decarbonize your heating, there won't be. The year-on-year embodied operational savings will be tiny. And it's 100 plus year paybacks, if at all. And certainly it's diminishing returns. So some of the projects I've seen of doing 250 mil or 300 mil of external wall insulation with rock wall and having to have special brackets to hold on whatever the external facade system is on the back of that. And at that level of depth of insulation, it definitely doesn't make sense. Glazing is an interesting one. High performance double glazing generally will have, well, if you're starting from single to double, there's lots of benefits of going from single to double. Going from double to triple, the embodied carbon doesn't make sense if you're replacing those windows from a double glaze to a triple glaze window.
Again, I'd say that depends on the windows to an extent, because there are some window companies that are making good advances in terms of reducing embodied carbon, you know.
On the glass?
Yeah, actually, there's been some manufacturing. I think it's... I don't know whether this has been commercialized, but there was an announcement by, God, was it? I have to get this right. I'm not sure whether it was Pilkington or Saint Gobain last year about very low carbon glass manufacturing.
Needs to happen. And that's my point. Is,
yeah.
I'm sat in a house with triple glazing, so I've undermined my own by fitting it in my home. There are lots of benefits beyond that, and people like
talking. Well, that's a great point. Yeah,
lots of other benefits beyond that. From a pure economic and carbon emissions perspective, if we said the whole country is going to fit triple glazing, that carbon emissions associated with that with the current glazing manufacturing processes will not make economic or carbon sense for the population. On those key metrics, and therefore the government subsidizing triple glazing over double glazing currently with high carbon glass being the predominant doesn't make sense. So some of this is around what's the right on a global scale or on a national scale, what's the right priority list? Because at the moment, most of the government subsidies support external wall insulation, internal wall insulation, and boiler replacements. And some funding for air source heat pumps.
But do you know what?
This is around what's is that the right priority? How do we get that mindset shift within Treasury, within DESNZ, within DLUHC around is that the right answer? And what's the different framing that would be useful? And that's partly what this is trying to do is a framing. And in certain homes, some of this nuance is there, definitely on solar and the deeper fabric stuff.
And if you've got vulnerable occupants who need higher temperatures and are in there all the time, for sheltered housing might be a different kind of case because you're not, again, it's like fuel poverty as well. When people talk about fuel poverty, you know, the first question I always ask people when they're talking about fuel poverty is, hang on, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to save carbon? Or are you trying to stop people dying? What are your motivations here? You know, but I think when it comes to how governments should design policies, I would have thought once we're satisfied that we've got, and we may not be quite there yet, robust assumptions and methodologies in place in terms of whole life carbon calculation, you just set targets in that regard. You set calculation and then ultimately targets in that regard. And if their methodologies are robust enough, you know, and you're balancing in that process embodied carbon and operational carbon, you can allow people flexibility, provided you're not making ridiculous assumptions as to how they get there.
So I would absolutely love it for the numbers to drive the answers in terms of you can't do a external wall insulation unless you can demonstrate it has high life carbon benefit. But what I think you'll find is if that became a build regulation, it would stop external wall insulation because at the moment you haven't got the supply chain to do it. So I think you need a general ratcheting up towards that, and then that becoming the norm, because that we absolutely need to deal with embodied carbon and grow a supply chain of materials that enables us to do the work we do need to do, but without having a huge impact on the environment. I'm also slightly wary that we set the wrong metrics. So I've been a strong advocate against the energy use intensity metrics that Leti and others are pushing, because I think that forces you to go to such a deep level of retrofit and deep level of new build that you actually end up with a higher carbon footprint building than you would have done with a slightly more relaxed viewpoint on that energy use intensity. So I know that a lot of people are very evangelical about that being the requirement, but when I've run the numbers and looked at new build housing, looked at existing homes, looked to be fair, mostly focused in housing, and maybe there's an argument in other sectors, but in housing, the 35 kilowatt hours square meter EUI is unachievable without even in many homes without going to passivhaus or even beyond on a new build setting. And I've also got concerns that it's driven by a PHBP engine that doesn't accurately reflect UK energy use. And that's some of the work we've been doing recently at Octopus. Is I've been getting into the data on how much homes use for electricity.
For the non-regulated loads, for the plug loads and stuff. Yeah.
And it's the default assumptions in PHBP are less than half what we see in reality. And SAP is actually fairly close to what we see in reality. There is some more nuance, and there is a massive spread. But you take an average, the average usage by sort of floor area is much closer to SAP than it is to PHBP. Default assumptions, you can change the assumptions in PHBP to increase the occupancy, and that will get you much closer. But that has a knock-on impact on particularly things like the energy use intensity assumptions. If you assume very low occupancy, that impacts you can achieve it, but you can't achieve it if you use SAP. So there's a few things there that I think, and a bit of discussion on LinkedIn yesterday with Chris Warboys around gas usage versus what PHPP says for different size of houses. And I don't think, again, I think partly because PHPP assumes 20 degrees, I think 24/7 and a low internal gains, it overestimates the heating assumption in homes compared to what we see. So look, we're getting into nuance of
that's interesting.
Software packages. But I do think understanding the real data and understanding what people's bills actually are and trying to coordinate the two to make sure that the tools that we're using are reflective of a UK average is important, particularly if you're using it then to define what you can and can't build. And I think they've tried to do that with this new home energy model, and there's lots of people concerned about it. But yeah, and it's interesting. Look at the Wimbish 10-year monitoring study, which is fantastic, and everyone definitely should look at that. The electricity use was significantly higher than PHPP had assumed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because people don't live like the PHPP assumption, which is a bottom-up assumption on usage. And it's much closer to the UK average electricity consumption for homes of that size.
Yeah.
So there are some interesting data points there, which I think should be considered, because it does impact on all of these metrics, and where you think the sweet spot will be will partly be dependent by what you put into the calculation engine you run.
Well, I think I certainly wouldn't expect... I would never have lent on PHPP too hard for the information on plug loads, because it's never really been the core focus, I think, of the standard. It's all been mainly focused on space heating demand and comfort. You know,
if you double the plug loads, you don't have to insulate anywhere near as much to get to 15 kilowatts square meter
because of the gains. That's interesting.
Would you mind explaining what that means, Jeff?
Heat loss from equipment. Basically,
oh, right.
Providing heat.
If your heating system is limited to, well, if you pass our target of 15 kilowatt hours per square meter of heating from the heating system, if you assume that, well, think of it this way, if you left your cooker all the time, you would need less heating. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Assumptions on how much the cooker's on and your telly's on and your lights are on is a lot lower than we actually see in the UK. In the only data I've seen from Octopus Energy's smart meter data, like half, then you actually need a lot less. When you add that in, you need less. Yeah. To hit the same 15 kilowatt hours, you could actually have a lower fabric spec.
What that suggests really is that the model in terms of PHPP in a UK context, for instance, maybe needs maybe broader than that. Maybe needs adjusting to make more allowance for internal gains. You know, yeah,
you can do it in PHPP, but I'm not sure you can in this. I'm not an expert in the certification stuff. Whether you have to, you've got some from a certification, but. I mentioned Chris Warboys earlier. He has written a tool for Bath and North East Somerset council planning applications that converts PHPP into SAP. And again, he's got a good post. Here, the link might be worth putting into the notes.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. The data, you know, there's a peer-reviewed paper I'll put into the show notes as well, which showed the space heating demand usage in passive houses being more or less, and that we've seen other studies along these lines, more or less, and this is 100 odd units across the UK in different schemes, more or less on the money in terms of being in line with the 15 kilowatt hour per square meter per annum target. And it might be that they're getting there for other reasons as well, you know, as you say. But I compare that to Evans Emerging in Ireland on homes built to our NZEB standard. It's a big developer we're talking to who's doing reporting on their scope 3 emissions, as required under the whatever it is, the Corporate Social Responsibility Directive or the SFD, I don't know if SFDR be affecting them, but they're applying a penalty of 50%. I think it's 40 to 50%, that kind of ballpark, on the NZEB homes, the building regs homes, basically, in Ireland, in terms of their regulated load usage, because the research in Ireland indicates that the actual usage is about 50%, 40, 50% higher than predicted.
Yeah. I mean, so if you look at the heat transfer coefficient tests that have been done, a non-passive house home, I think in that data set, it's got about a 20% fabric performance gap, and the passive house schemes were sort of 0 to 10%, so average about 5% performance gap. And some of the non-passive households were sort of 50%, 100% over, but the average was about 20%. And in the data that I've been looking at from Oxford's perspective, I think the gas meter usage is about 40% more than an EPC on recently built homes. So heating and hot water, gas usage compared to the actual gas usage in the metering, we've done a bit of a look at that. And that's about the number. And I think some of that is performance gap, and some of that is they're probably used slightly more to a slightly higher temperature than SAP assumes.
Yeah.
But I think passive house is almost too far the other way. I don't think people are generally in the UK heating their homes to 20 degrees 24/7. So,
well, and it'd be fascinating to see, and I wonder whether Octopus have a data on this, and if they did, whether they'd be willing to share it, how energy prices affect behavior in terms of, say, you know, comfort and so on, you know, and do people become more miserly in their usage when things like Russia, you know, invade Ukraine?
So we're just about to publish a paper with Cambridge University on the value that we see from zero bills homes. And as part of that, we've looked at the EPC rating of homes and the actual energy bills that we have, our customers have paid by their EPC rating over the last 5 years. So back in 2019, an A and B rated home was about £850 and an E rated home was about £1,200. And there's a chart which shows when the 2022, 2023 prices go up, that there is still a significant difference. And so it's £2,000 to £3,000 in 2023, average for an B rated to an E rated, sorry, F rated. The G rated homes are a bit odd because most G rated homes have got oil and solid fuels and other heating sources. But yeah, for our dual fuel customers, you would expect the EFs and Gs to be slightly higher than they are, but not massively. What we found interesting was even an A and a B rated home, which is basically what almost all new build homes in the UK are, that sort of standard, still last year had an average energy bill of £2,000. So not £3,000 for an F rated home.
But people, you know, if you've got a very inefficient home, people do put up with discomfort. I think that's just one of the things that maybe you, I'm wrong in that. I don't know, but that's my, it's that old put on the jumper kind of thing or whatever, you know?
I think that's been an essential way of how people have coped with all of with winter generally, but particularly since the price rises.
In the worst homes, they're not as bad as you expect them to be. But what is interesting is getting to a very good fabric standard doesn't get you down from 3,000 down to sort of 500 or a zero. It only gets you down so far. And that's because your heating in a new build home to the current regs is about a quarter of your overall energy bill. Mm. It might be more than half of your energy use, but because the difference in price between gas and electricity, and when you add the standing charges in,
yeah,
much lower proportion of your energy bill, because electricity is four times the price of gas. So typically half your bill is your appliance use, cooking appliances, lights, fans, tellies, computers, etc. And in a new build home, about a quarter is your hot water and a quarter is about your heating. And the standing charges are in there as well. And the standing charges are a pretty significant part of people's bills, about 10%. So actually getting that quarter to zero by going to no heating will reduce your bill by a quarter, but it won't reduce it to zero. So
yeah,
stuff we've been doing at Octopus is trying to get homes to zero energy bills. And the only way we think you can do that is through step four on my list of five, solar and storage.
Right.
Do you want to just, we've mentioned the zero energy bills homes that you're working on with Octopus. Do you just want to introduce that as a concept? Because it's a really fascinating endeavor.
So it's something that we're looking at Ilka, and how far can we go with our product, and looking at what we do around truly zero carbon homes in operation. So not including the on-body, but the operational carbon, trying to get to the point where you're generating as much as you're using, and you're on an annual basis, operation is zero carbon. And in doing that, we realized we were getting to a point where if you're generating more and you're using, if the cost of energy in and the cost of energy out was the same, you would have no energy bills. So we put, and at the time, Octopus had a tariff with Tesla, which had an equal price in and out. And so we went to Octopus and said, could we get to a point where we could get to a zero energy bill? And the Octopus team got very excited about that and worked up a proposal. And we're now rolling that out globally, actually. The basic premise is you need to have an all-electric home, no gas to the home or other solid fuels. And we need a lot of solar because we need to be able to generate enough solar to generate more than we use. And we need to have a battery to shift the load of when you're using energy. And we need to smart control the heat pump. So we will smart control the heat pump, we'll smart control the battery, and we will look to export energy back to the grid at higher cost times and reduce the cost of importing by doing the hot water at night or in the afternoon when it's sunny. And off the back of that, Octopus will guarantee that house has no energy bills.
So as an entity, wow, in those circumstances, Octopus shifts from being an energy supplier to a consumer to like a sort of macro microgrid energy arbitrage trader.
That's exactly it. And for the consumer living in the home, they set their thermostat on the wall or on the app and live their life normally. and they don't have an energy bill. So all the complicated stuff is done in the background, because we can smart control the heat pump to say energy is going to be cheap, or it's going to be sunny in the hot water at this time. And then with the battery, we can work out, when do we want to charge up that battery? Do you want to charge it up at night because the energy is free because it's very windy? Or do you want to charge it up in the day because it's going to be sunny? And then when do we want to put that energy back into the grid, or do we want to use it, save it to use in the home overnight? So yeah, we do that optimization across hundreds of thousands of cars now on their smart charging of cars, and we get a low tariff for EV charging. It's that same technology, the Kraken platform that Octopus has, that can smart control batteries, heat pumps, and cars. And what we're able to do is guarantee a zero energy bill. It's worth saying there are some caveats. It's not limitless free energy. There is a usage policy, set at double typical consumption, and we exclude electric vehicle charging because that can almost double someone's electricity use. But they can that's done on our Intelligent Octopus Go tariff, which is 7.5 pence kilowatt hour, works out about 2 pence a mile for most cars. So it's still very cheap to charge a car. And if you have got certain car brands now, we launched a week or two ago a vehicle to grid tariff, which is free charging. So if you let us discharge your battery slightly before we recharge it, we will discharge it into the grid in the evening when we can generate revenues from putting some energy back into the grid, and that will more than offset the cost of recharging the battery in full. So that you can have a free home and a free car, but it's limited cars at the moment, limited brands.
I mean, some of the car brands, I think, were a bit... So go on, Dan.
Jeff, just before you start asking questions, we're not going to get into this deep because we've agreed to do an episode with Nigel's boss about this.
I mean, I can ask this question and you can cut it out, Dan, if you want to save it. He, when you talk about guaranteeing, you know, with these caveats, zero energy bills, how long are you guaranteeing that for?
So we expect it to be an ongoing rolling zero bill tariff. So we don't expect to ever charge a bill while the equipment's running, but we have put a guarantee on it, and we guarantee it currently for 5 years. We are looking at extending that guarantee out to 10 years because we're confident that the homes will generate, if the equipment's running, we're confident in the future energy market that we'll be able to still have a zero bill. Certainly as far as we can see in the energy market. So the cost of energy varies massively through the day, and actually through very high energy cost periods like we've had recently, actually we get more value from the generation, which increases, and we have to pay more for the import, and it balances. So actually the zero actually works out really, really quite well. In the future, we're going to get more periods of high wind, very low cost, as more wind farms come online. So we'll get lots more negative and low price energy times. We're still going to get still periods where it's not windy and the cost of energy is going to be very high. So we still think we'll have, even when we move to a world of a lot more EVs and a lot more, we'll have a lot more wind on the system. And we still think that variability of price will still be there. So we think this is direction of travel of where it's going. And most people who have fitted solar and battery systems or have got an EV and have got their head around the cost of energy, how it varies through the day, are now pretty evangelical about those bits of equipment. They're not the complete answer. That's why Fabric is fifth on the list, but they do make a massive difference to your energy bill. If you can generate your own energy, store it, and then particularly if you can use it, then only use energy at low times.
Amazing.
So we'll be getting into this in much more depth on a future episode, because it's really, really interesting that as a prospect, because what Octopus is doing is defining a building standard for zero energy bills homes, getting builders to agree to it and build to them. And Octopus's own business model is effectively a post-occupancy evaluation scheme from which they make money. So you catalyze the supply chain at all levels and show the fucking ignorant or idiotic government that decarbonization of the grid is a viable proposition in pure capitalism red in tooth and claw terms, which should presumably stimulate them in the same way that the RSEC that caused this energy crisis, where arbitrage of energy prices was a means of making money for people like the C-suite of Bulb, before it all collapsed and we all ended up paying for it anyway.
we're very excited about the zero bills proposition, and definitely keen to get Michael on to talk about that, because it creates a commercially viable proposition for people to voluntarily build to a high standard. And if you build to a passive house standard, you need less solar on the roof. So that we're not saying don't build to a high standard. In fact, building to a higher standard means you need slightly less solar because we take into account the fact that there's less heating and therefore we need less solar or a smaller battery to achieve our zero bills specification. So yeah, and that's the point, I guess. If you do the full list, heat pump, smart tariff, measuring, solar and storage with good fabric, you get to zero bills. And I guess the bit that was challenging, I think, for some people, is that actually fabric wasn't number one on that list. It was at the bottom of the list, because from an economics point of view and from a carbon point of view, in my mind, that is the priority list.
So how much did you piss people off? Because I know, like, one of the things we get feedback on, and I see people commenting on it, is where we often facetiously say, fuck fabric first. Fuck it, it doesn't matter. Because, like, often there is a high embodied carbon, the payback period, like financial payback, sort of muddies the waters. And we are advocates of heat pumpification. So thank you, Richard Lowes and Toby Cambrough. Yeah. What was the feedback like?
Some people definitely have come back on it and pushed back and have questioned, if we don't do the fabric works, will we not need a grid three times the size of the grid we've got now? Certainly the analysis that I've seen doesn't support that. Talking to a lot of the distribution network operators, they're not overly concerned about heat pumps. They're more concerned around EV chargers, partly because heat pumps generally, the smart controlling of EV chargers, that they don't add more load at 5 o'clock in the evening. Heat pumps generally don't add a huge amount of load in that evening peak. Do we need a three times size grid, and what's the embodied carbon of that? And we will be able to build all that grid. So I don't think it's anywhere near as high as that. And the analysis I've seen doesn't show anything near as that. There isn't, as a lot of people say, well, what is the analysis behind that? And there is more work to be done in that space, I think, to see what is the balance between upgrading wires and building new pylons, adding smart controls and moving when the energy is around, which we think is a much better way of doing things, and insulating homes. And there may well be some homes in rural Aviemore that need three phase heat pumps, because you have to upgrade the whole electricity network for kilometers. So it may make sense in geographical locations as well as fuel poverty locations to do more on the fabric. But in the same argument that a lot of people said, well, we haven't got the people to do all this electrical infrastructure, we haven't got the people to do all this fabric work either.
Yeah.
And from a few people have supported the sort of messaging around heat pumps, basic measures, and solar, because there's an existing workforce that can roll that at a reasonable scale and could reskill to do that at a lot more scale. Whereas the fabric measures, as per Fionn's discussion last week, was very much to do fabric well does require a lot more care, knowledge, and experience, and can go wrong if it's done badly at scale. So we're not saying don't do it, but it needs a lot more care, and it probably needs to be prioritized where the homes that need it most, which might be socioeconomic reasons, but it might also be grid reasons as well.
Well, it strikes me, what I love about the fabric fifth approach is not everyone's going to do it. There are limits to how it's going to be applied, not just because of its iconoclasm, just because, well, the industry won't enable everyone to just switch to heat pumps immediately. Like you said, there's already a backlog. But in a political and economic environment where everything has to be market-based decisions, like, such an approach enables the activity of consumers to catalyze development. So you switch everyone to heat pumps, it is manageable. Everyone's got shoved onto smart meters, sort of, anyway. Like, you beef up that as a service to enable them to manage their own usage better. Like, all of a sudden you begin to make the grid upgrade a much more viable proposition through demand and actually demonstrating what's required. And it's not going to be a sea change. It's not like we've been told by the incumbent government and the incoming one, we ain't investing in infrastructure, lads. Not a chance. But there will be investment as and when it has to be made, and that is what the market does.
And we're seeing it now with electric vehicles becoming the predominant choice, where most people are saying their next car will be an electric car, and it's partly because they're now cheaper to run, lower maintenance, people are seeing that they do work, they're fine, you can get them charged generally. Still have problematic points if you're going down to the Cornwall on a Friday afternoon. And we'll get to that point, hopefully, with heat pumps. There are some things the government could do which would make it a lot better. All the tariffs are on electricity, the charges, grid grid charges, et cetera, on electricity rather than gas and rebalancing that, which the government said it will do, and relaxing some of the planning rules, which again are being done. So there are some positive moves, and hopefully that will move from a sort of green niche early adopter or even innovator sort of level of folk who are probably those that are engaging now into a mass market solution, and that will start to happen. And the reason for saying Fabric Fifth and not Fabric First is at the moment, a lot of people are saying Fabric First, do that before you get a heat pump. And I think to some extent, that's an argument that's being pushed by those that have interest in that happening, because it stops heat pumps getting installed keeps gas flowing. So
also, it's an article of dogma that there is a cohort of professionals who aren't yet willing to let go of it, because it was a tenet of their faith, and it is now being fundamentally challenged, and it hurts, that shit.
And what I'd say is, most people who I've spoken to who have run the numbers themselves have come around to it. So anyone that's vehemently disagreeing with everything we've been saying for the last hour.
Run the numbers. Even the Pacifist Institute themselves will tell you that Enerfit isn't always the solution, you know? So there's a recognition that deep retrofit isn't always going to, you know, even from their position, isn't always going to be appropriate, you know?
I absolutely get the broader benefits, air quality, comfort, etc. And if you've got the money, you can afford to do it, and you want to do it, and you can do it with low carbon materials, crack on. Should it be the default, and should it sort of be used as a reason not to do heat pumps?
No,
That's the main bit that hopefully is the message that lands. It's on the list. It's fifth.
What I would love to see happening in the kind of approach that you're talking about is a route, and this is where the AECB's step-by-step approach is so interesting, is that one of the elements that they bake in from the start is that if you're going to go, you know, heat pump and light touch fabric and ventilation at the same time, that you do the retrofit in such a way, you know, that you are not making it hard to go back and do subsequent measures. That seems eminently sensible to me. And it's even, you know, like, because pushing further than what they're describing, this distressed boiler breakdown scenario, I think it's really interesting to be looking at that, you know, create a solution where you can put a heat pump in now on the same day, right? But that you explain to the homeowner that this is the first step of the process. It may be that they're happy with this. Maybe that they switch up to a zero bills tariff with Octopus, for instance, that they, maybe the next step is PV and storage, who knows? But the point is that you're explaining to them that in addition to giving them some useful kind of guidance on how to operate the heat pump in this, what might be suboptimal condition, you're clearly showing them what the next steps will be if they're not satisfied 2 months down the line or whatever it might be. Once you've got a sense of, and you talk to the homeowner about their experience of running that heat pump, and you know, is that something easy sensing?
If you fit a suboptimal heat pump, as in a higher temperature heat pump, there's generally two reasons for that. You haven't insulated the home well enough to enable you to go lower temperature, or you haven't upgraded the radiators to a larger radiators to allow enough heat to come out to do that. So you have to run at a higher temperature. I think, fitting higher temperature heat pumps mean people can get going, can get off gas, and they can run it at slightly higher temperatures, but explain to them that if they did a bit more insulation, or when they refurbish that room, they put bigger radiators, particularly there's often one or two radiators in a home that aren't quite big enough, which mean the whole home has to run at 55 rather than at 45. And that might reduce your scop from 4 to 3.5. But those are your two options. You need more on the fabric insulation works, or larger radiators will now allow you to, or underfloor heating will allow you to get to a lower flow temperature and a higher efficiency of the heat pump. Obviously, if you do the insulation, you're also getting higher efficiency and less need for the heat pump to be on it, in it at all, which is sort of a double benefit. But that secondary retrofitting after having a heat pump fitted, can help lower the amount of heat you need and lower the temperature and get more efficiency from your heat pump. But I think it's important that people see that there are sort of, there's two bits to that equation which will help improve performance. And that's something that probably isn't brilliantly well explained at the moment, and something that people need to get their head around as get heat pumps in, run at higher temperature now, and in the future, do some more fabric works, great, or get some bigger radiators, and you'll make even more savings than you would do running it now.
Well, I think, there's a whole heap of activation stuff in marketing terms that isn't being dealt with
for the heat, by or for the heat pump industry. So back to both Mrs. Miggins and Mrs. Murphy. We can presume that they are not necessarily hostile to heat pumps. They don't know enough. They are hostile to change, and they wouldn't change a boiler for no reason. So when push comes to shove and the boiler breaks down, they need something to change over immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Right. They need that fixed. So should happenstance dictate that a heat pump could be installed, jobs are good. However, we know to be predominantly true that that ain't going to be possible. And so where they need their boiler replaced, they're going to get a boiler rather than a heat pump, right? So what's missing from this whole... Right, so I moved into this house a year last October. Every month, I get at least one or two pieces of communication from local estate agents asking me if I'm ready to sell.
Yeah.
They probably... No, in fact, they definitely have access to the professional Rightmove. So they know when this house was bought. And in all likelihood, they know that I'm not going to be selling. Well, my missus and I, we ain't selling. We moved in, we're happy. But they know if they drip feed these comms metronomically, that eventually when I am ready, when I'm thinking about it, that I'm going to reach out to one of them. Why can't we do something similar for boiler replacement? Because everyone knows your boilers have a shelf life. I don't know if there is data out there in the marketplace where you could find out about installs and boiler ages. But the idea that ship folk could be starting this campaign to, it is a truth that your boiler is going to break down at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Like we pitched this idea a little while ago. Death tactics, your boiler's going to break. Like we can be sure of these things. So why not prepare people for it?
And I think there's an the clean heat mechanism, market mechanism is being proposed that, again, there's been some strong pushback from the manufacturers of gas boilers in particular and their trade association. It requires them to fit a certain percentage of their heating systems as being heat pumps, and it ratchets up over time. And they're best placed actually to know when boilers are older, because they often will have installed it and have a registered warranty on that boiler. So they'll know when it's installed and when it's probably 10 years old, 12 years old. And so that they could use that to help them drive a marketing campaign to fit heat pumps. So all the boiler manufacturers have got heat pump brands. Worcester Bosch, Ideal, etc. have got a heat pump solution they're working on or they market and sell. And across Europe, it's increasingly heat pumps are being used predominantly in the UK, which is we're not there yet. And we have got to still massively upskill the existing gas boiler workforce to be able to fit heat pumps. My view is they are eminently capable of doing that. And we're seeing that because a lot of the people going to Octopus to fit heat pumps are ex gas boiler.
Yeah, like they're simple pieces of kit, especially if they're monoblocks. You know, there's no refrigerant engineer required. It's just a couple of pipes basically at either end of it, you know. I'm not wanting to be too glib, but you know, they're not as complex as they sound, and they're not as newfangled as they sound, you know.
Presuming the design is fit for purpose.
Well, there's that, but that's not that's a separate issue. Yeah.
But no, it's not a separate issue. It is a contingent issue. Like, it is sequential. Like, if you install the wrong heat pump to suit the space, you can end up with dissatisfied customers, pollute the marketplace with negativity, stifle growth.
I mean, the reality, it's probably fair to say, Nigel, is sorry for getting you off, Dan. In fact, I'm enjoying it. The reality is that with gas boilers and oil boilers, that manufacturers tend to put in massively oversized boilers, really, don't they? And consequently as well, you know, you could have a condensing boiler that's meant to be highly efficient, but condensing boilers only condense if they're running long enough to get into condensing mode. And if you are achieving your required temperatures, you know, as soon as you're firing it up, then you're not getting those efficiencies, you know?
Yeah. And that's one of the part of the sort of winter workout sort of program around giving people advice. I know Nesta have been pushing a lot on this around lowering your flow temperature of your boiler, because we've been fitting condensing boilers and almost none of them have been actually in condensing mode since they've been installed. And also, your boiler will last longer if it's on condensing mode, and also you'll be also running at lower flow temperatures, getting used to warm, not burning hot radiators and weather compensation. All that good stuff and good heating system design should be being done with gas boilers already, but really isn't. But again,
yeah.
upskilling people to be aware of that now would be a useful process. And I think that's something that we need to be upskilling more heat engineers, because I think your point around, could you drip feed in more information about heat pumps now? If there is a big grant available, that is because there's a big grant available, that has meant there is now a backlog of, for most good heat pump installers to companies to do. So we don't actually need to pump prime a huge amount of extra volume now, but
yeah,
over time we need to be bringing in more people and then really ratcheting up the volume of installations. And that is largely about upskilling existing people. It's not trying to create a new trade workforce. And again, going back to the Fabric Fifth, to do 100,000, 200,000 solid wall installations a year, which is probably where we need to be getting up towards just to do the fuel poor households, is a massive workforce enhancement. And most of the people that were doing that work are no longer doing that work or no longer in the country.
Right, yeah.
Man, I wonder about this as a philosophy, if you like, Fabric Fifth. I wonder whether this is viable for people like social housing providers, because there is a tendency. So again, Fionn last week complaining, there is a paradigm which social housing providers in their enthusiasm, ambition, and perhaps ignorance go for. Do everything all at once and get it done. Where we could take a much more measured approach in upgrading piecemeal and doing the things that are going to make a difference.
There's certainly a real challenge at the moment that there isn't really a government incentive program at any sort of scale that supports heat pump installations in social housing. So there's a £7,500 boiler upgrade screen grant for owner occupiers and tenanted houses, but not for social housing. So you can't get a grant towards it. There is this social housing decarbonisation fund, but to date, that's been largely focused on fabric measures. I think they are shifting it in this wave three that's about to come out to cover heat pumps. But yeah, we've been in a ridiculous situation where 50, 60, 70, even £100,000 have been spent on the fabric of a home, and the gas boiler has been left in place and system hasn't been upgraded. So really thinking about getting done what needs to get done, those homes still need to be retrofit. Again, with a heat pump, having spent £100,000 retrofit than with a fabric wrap. So look, some of that is driven by the policy and the mechanisms that are available. And unfortunately, because there isn't much money available in the social housing sector to deal with all the other things they've got to deal with, the works are being done, have been done where there is some grant funding available. And therefore, shifting that grant funding to support heat pumps, to insist on lower embodied carbon being part of the volume of work and ratcheting that up, really could unlock a massive sea change. And the social housing sector has always been fantastic at ramping up and delivering at scale, because they've got the supply chains, they've got their own direct labor organizations, and yeah, they've got enough stock that they can do significant scale. And I really think they can be a massive force for good in driving this agenda. But the policy support mechanisms and the grant regimes really need to help them do that. And that's something that we've been suggesting off the back of this sort of Fabric Fifth approach, that government should be thinking about perhaps reconsidering how some of their stuff's done. And I'm pleased that the Wave 3 SHDF is much more open to heating than it was just being on fabric before.
Well, I should say one issue that we encountered through discussions I've been having in my role at the Heat Pump Association is...
He doesn't like to mention it, but he's the chair of the Heat Pump Association of Ireland.
Jesus. The grid operator has concerns about, you know, if you do, for instance, a new build in particular, if you get like, you know, a new housing estate with a few hundred heat pumps all coming on at the same kind of time and all set up to flash the hot water up to high temperature to, you know, there's a cycle, a Legionella cycle that's required in Ireland, that you could end up causing localized pressure for the grid. So these are all issues that can potentially be designed around. But are these considerations that you're thinking about in terms of how you put your kind of your tariffs and your kind of your zero energy goals kind of proposals together?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the issue is unlikely to be individual heat pumps all firing at the same time on their own, because even a typical heat pump probably is only going to get up to about 2 kilowatts at night if it's been done on a programmed setting. It's the combination of a heat pump, a battery, and EV chargers all being programmed to come on at the same time, which will create a sort of what we call a secondary spike, potentially at night, if it's on a very simple on-off type, economy 7 type tariff that everyone comes on at midnight. I think that is a concern that DNOs are aware of. And then the other concern is this equipment runs on top of the existing peak that happens in the evening. so the primary peak rather than the secondary peak. But a lot of that can be managed through smart control, and smart control nationally, but also smart control locally. So a lot of the work we're doing is not only do we listen to the signals from the national grid and the pricing market, but we actually listen to the local frequency and local grid services requirements and engage with DNOs around their problems locally in congestion to be able to turn on and off. You need to massively enhance the electrical infrastructure, because we are unlocking much cheaper energy for people and making use of renewables when it's available, and turning down the amount of energy you use when you'd otherwise have to turn on a coal power plant.
Aware that we need to wrap up. What happened to Ilka? Well, we've got you. It would be remiss of us not to ask the question. And I am aware that we might have to edit out some of your response.
Yeah, look, Ilka was, in my view, it was doing a lot of great things. We had challenges on some of our sites. We hadn't grown as fast as we needed to hit break even point. Until you hit break even, you're reliant on cash from other parties. It was horrific.
It's a shame. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, you got some PTSD from it, I'm sure. It's a conversation from another day. I am going to have to be rude, because my wife has just texted that our kids have been let out of school. They're at home now. It's the first snow day here since the Beast from the East, literally. So we've got the Gulf Stream and stuff. So I've gotten sent photos of them in the park in the trying to take advantage of the melting snow. So I'm going to go out and get on a, we have a plastic sled. We're going to go on embarrass myself in a park now. You know,
All right, igloo, Jeff. That's your challenge. Me and my kids build an igloo.
I think it'll be falling apart. It is melting quite a lot now, so it's wishful thinking. You know, it's like my wife is Australian, and when she was growing up, it snowed once when she was a kid in Adelaide, where she's from, and she had a cup. She got a cup, put the snow in the cup, and kept it in the freezer for like a year. So it's a bit like that. Yeah, my kids will be my daughter certainly, I think, actually probably has no proper memory of snow, which is a really strange thing, you know. But sure, look, the Gulf Stream will, and the AMOC will collapse, and then we'll have all that lovely glaciers coming for us to look forward to in a climate ruined world. Yeah.
Yeah, well, they talk about melting glaciers being a problem. Let's bring them back just elsewhere.
Okay. Listen, great speaking to you, Nigel. Thank you so much. You've been very insightful, and I agree with you more than you might think. I think there's an awful lot of very interesting points that you're making, and it's very exciting to see what Octopus can achieve.
Well, thank you very much. Look, we're excited about it and really hope to get as many people on board. So people are interested in the zero bills or what we're doing, then get in touch. Thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, no, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. And we'll drop all the links in the show notes that we gather or remember. I'll email you, Nigel, as I go through the edit, if there's anything I can't lay my hands on. All right. Well, thank you for joining us, everyone at home. Hope you've enjoyed it too. The last things, usual things. Join ACAN, join the AECB, join the IGBC, and women, check her own space. Check Lloyd Alter's Substack, Upfront Carbon. Check Passive House Plus. Subscribe and advertise if you are in a position to do so. This might be a viable opportunity for Octopus Energy, perhaps. I don't know. You guys surely have the budgets to be able to throw a bit of money their way. We shall see.
Don't ask him for an answer on the podcast, Dan. That's not, not really very fair. Yeah.
talk to us if you've got any projects that you think we should know about, or if you want to talk to us about any of the stuff that we're doing professionally, just give us a shout. We're happy just to talk about this stuff. It doesn't necessarily have to lead to actual work. It is all interesting. Oh, and if you get something out of this, you probably know someone else who will as well, so please share it with them. And if you don't and you do get something out of it, please review it or just give us a 5-star rating. It has to be 5 stars. Nothing else matters. And if you can't be asked with any of that, fine. Thank you for listening. Any plugs you've got to add, Nigel?
No, all I'd say is get yourself a heat pump if you haven't got one already, and you can get a quote from Octopus in about 20 seconds on our website.
Oh, my God. I'll make sure all the links are in the show notes, and in particular, a link to the article that was on LinkedIn. Yeah, that'll be there. So, all right, cheers. Goodbye.